6 months later, as Keiko Yamasuki sank into the deepening cold and was about to enter hibernation, the cold froze and filtered out the riot of noise in her mind. This brought the thread of her focused thoughts into sharp relief in the lonely darkness, like the moment 10 years before when Luo Ji plunged into the icy lake. All of a sudden, her hazy thoughts became unusually clear, like the chilly sky in the dead of winter. She wanted to shout for the hibernation to stop, but it was too late. The ultra-low temperatures had seeped into her body, and she had lost the ability to produce sound. The operators and doctors noticed that, just as she was entering hibernation, her eyes suddenly opened a crack, revealing an expression full of horror and despair. If the cold hadn't frozen her eyelids, her eyes would have been wide open. But this was just a normal reflex during the process that had been seen on previous hibernators, so they paid it no mind. The UNPDC Wallfacer project hearing deliberated the stellar hydrogen bomb test. The giant breakthrough in computing technology meant that computers were at last capable of handling the theoretical stellar model of a nuclear explosion developed over the past decade, and the manufacture of large-yield stellar hydrogen bombs could begin forthwith. The projected yield of the first bomb was the equivalent of 350 megatons of TNT, or 7 times more powerful than the largest hydrogen bomb ever manufactured by humanity. It was impossible for this superbomb to be tested in the atmosphere, and a detonation in an underground shaft of the depth previously used would eject the surrounding rock into the air, so testing on Earth would require digging an ultra-deep shaft. But even detonating in an ultra-deep shaft would cause powerful shockwaves to spread across the world and might have an unanticipated effect on a broad range of geological structures, possibly touching off disasters including earthquakes and tsunamis. Therefore, the stellar hydrogen bomb could only be tested in space. Yet it was impossible in high orbit because at that distance, the electromagnetic pulse the bomb generated would have a catastrophic effect on Earth's telecommunications and power systems. The ideal test location, then, was on the backside of the moon. However, Ray Diaz chose differently. "I've decided to conduct the tests on Mercury," he said. This proposal surprised the representatives in attendance, and they voiced questions about the meaning of the plan. "According to the basic principles of the Wallfacer plan, I do not have to explain," he answered icily. "The tests should be conducted underground. We need to dig ultra-deep shafts on Mercury." The Russian representative said, "We can consider tests on the surface of Mercury, but underground tests are too expensive. Digging deep shafts there could cost 100 times what a similar engineering project would cost on Earth. Besides, the effects of a nuclear bomb on the environment of Mercury would tell us nothing useful. Even a surface test on Mercury is impossible," the U.S. representative said. "To date, Ray Diaz has consumed the most resources of all the Wallfacers. The time has come to stop him." This sentiment was echoed by representatives from the UK, France, and Germany. Ray Diaz said with a laugh, "Even if I use as few resources as Dr. Luo, you'd still be keen to veto my plan." He turned to the rotating chair. "I would ask the chair and each representative to remember that out of all the strategies proposed by the Wallfacers, my plan is most closely in harmony with mainstream defense, to the point that you could view it as part of the mainstream. In absolute numbers, the consumption of resources might look large, but a considerable portion of that overlaps the mainstream. Therefore," the UK representative cut him off. you still ought to explain why you need to conduct underground tests on Mercury, unless you're just doing it to spend money. We can't find any explanation for it.
Mr. Chair, representatives, Ray Diaz countered calmly, you may have noticed that the PDC no longer has even the barest respect for Wallfacers or for the Wallfacer principle. If we have to explain every detail of our plans, then how is the Wallfacer project meaningful?
One by one, he turned his scorching gaze on every representative, forcing them to turn away. He went on, even so, I am willing to offer an explanation of the issue just raised. The goal of conducting deep underground tests on Mercury is to blast out a large cave on the planet to serve as a future Mercury base. This is clearly the most economical way of conducting an engineering project of this kind. His words stirred up whispers, and one representative asked,
Wallfacer Ray Diaz, do you mean you want to use Mercury as the launch base for stellar hydrogen bombs?
With confidence, Ray Diaz answered, yes. Current strategic theory in mainstream defense holds that emphasis should be placed on the outer planets, and so the inner planets, which are not believed to be defensively significant, have not been given sufficient attention. The Mercury base I have planned is intended to mend this weak link in mainstream defense.
He's afraid of the sun, but he wants to go to the planet closest to it. Isn't that a little strange? The U.S. representative said.
There was a bit of laughter, followed by a warning from the chair.
It doesn't matter, Mr. Chair. I've grown accustomed to this lack of respect. I was used to it even before I became a Wallfacer, Ray Diaz said with a wave of his hand. But all of you should respect the facts at hand. When the outer planets and Earth have fallen, the Mercury base will be the last bastion of humanity. Backed by the sun and situated amid the cover of radiation, it will be the most rugged of positions.
Wallfacer Ray Diaz, does this mean that your plan's entire significance lies in a last stand when humanity's situation is already hopeless?
This is quite consistent with your character, the French representative said.
Gentlemen, we can't simply refuse to consider the final resistance, Ray Diaz said gravely.
Very well, Wallfacer Ray Diaz, the chair said. Now, would you be able to tell us, in your overall deployment scenario, how many stellar hydrogen bombs you'll need, all told?
The more the better. Manufacture as many as the Earth has capacity to produce. The special number depends on the yield that hydrogen bombs will be able to achieve in the future. But according to current figures, the first batch in the deployment plan requires at least 1 million.
Laughter shook the auditorium at Ray Diaz's words.
Evidently, Wallfacer Ray Diaz doesn't just want to make a small sun, he wants to make a small galaxy, the U.S. representative said loudly. Then he leaned toward Ray Diaz.
Do you really think that the ocean's protium, deuterium, and tritium were prepared just for you? Because of your perverted affection for the bomb, the Earth should be turned into a bomb workshop?
By this point, Ray Diaz was the only one in the assembly with a straight face. He waited quietly until the clamour he had sparked died down, and then said, one word at a time,
This is the ultimate war of the human race. So the number I ask for is not at all large, but I did anticipate today's outcome. Nevertheless, I will work hard. I will build bombs. I will build as many as I can, I tell you. I will work hard, and I won't stop.
In response, the representatives of the US, UK, and France put forth a joint proposal, P269, to terminate the strategic plan of Wallfacer Ray Diaz. Only two colours were visible on the surface of Mercury, black and gold.
The black was the planet's land, and its low reflectance meant that even under close illumination from the fierce sun, it remained a sheet of black. The gold was the sun, which occupied a considerable portion of the sky. In its broad wheel you could clearly see the surging of its fiery seas and the sunspots drifting by like black clouds, and at its edges the graceful dance of solar prominences. And on this hard chunk of rock suspended atop the sun's fiery sea, humanity was planting another small sun. With the completion of the space elevator, humanity had begun the large-scale exploration of the other planets in the solar system. Manned spacecraft landings on Mars and the moons of Jupiter had not caused much of a stir because people knew that the purpose of these expeditions was much clearer and more practical than in the past. They were purely intended to establish bases for the defense of the solar system. These voyages, which relied mainly on chemical propulsion rockets and spacecraft, were merely the tiniest of steps toward that goal. Initial explorations focused primarily on the outer planets, but as the study of space strategy deepened, neglecting the strategic value of the inner planets was increasingly called into question. Hence, the exploration of Venus and Mercury was stepped up, and so it was that the PDC narrowly passed Ray Diaz's plan to test the stellar hydrogen bomb on Mercury. Excavating the shaft through the rock of Mercury was the first large-scale engineering project humanity had undertaken on another planet in the solar system. Because construction could only take place during Mercury's night, in stretches of 88 Earth days, the project would take 3 years to complete. However, in the end, it only reached one-third of the projected depth, due to the discovery of an unusually hard layer farther down, a mixture of metal and rock. Continued excavation would be much slower and far more costly. Ultimately, it was decided to terminate the project. If tests were carried out at the present depth, the surrounding rock would most certainly be ejected by the blast and would form a crater, making it basically a watered-down atmospheric test. And because of the interference from the surrounding crust, it would be far harder to observe the test's outcome than with a purely atmospheric test. But Ray Diaz thought that if a cover were fitted onto this crater, it could still serve as a base, and insisted on conducting the test underground at the current depth. The test was carried out at dawn. Sunrise on Mercury was a process that took over 10 hours, and a faint light had just appeared on the horizon. When the detonation countdown reached zero, rings of ripples centered on ground zero spread outward, and the ground on Mercury seemed momentarily to become soft as satin. Then, at the blast site, a mountain slowly rose like the back of a waking giant. When the peak had risen to around 3,000 meters, the entire mountain exploded, sending billions of tons of mud and rock flying into the air in a towering display of rage by the ground toward the sky. And alongside the surging ground came the radiant light of the underground nuclear fireball, which shone on the rock and earth flying through the air to cause a grand spectacle of fireworks in the black Mercury sky. The fireball lasted for 5 minutes, as chunks of rock fell to the ground amid a nuclear glow before it went out. 10 hours after the conclusion of the blast, observers noticed that a ring had appeared around Mercury. This was due to the considerable amount of rock that had achieved cosmic velocity in the violent explosion and had turned into myriad satellites of various sizes. They spread out evenly in orbit, making Mercury the first ringed terrestrial planet. The ring was thin, and as it sparkled in the harsh light of the sun, it looked almost like someone had taken a highlighter to the planet. another proportion of the rocks achieved escape velocity and left Mercury behind entirely, becoming satellites of the Sun in their own right and forming an extremely sparse asteroid belt in Mercury's orbit. Ray Diaz lived underground, not out of any concern for security, but because of his heliophobia. The claustrophobic environment, far removed from the sunshine, made him feel a little more comfortable. He watched the live broadcast of the Mercury test from the basement where he lived. It wasn't actually live, since the images took about 7 minutes to reach Earth. When the blast on Mercury had concluded, and the rock rain was still falling in the post-fireball darkness, he received a telephone call from the rotating chair of the PDC, who said that the tremendous power of the stellar hydrogen bombs had made a deep impression on the PDC leadership, and that the permanent member states had requested that the next Wallfacer hearing be held as soon as possible to discuss the bombs' manufacture and deployment. The chair said that although the number of bombs Ray Diaz had requested was an impossibility, the major powers were indeed interested in the production of this weapon. Over 10 hours after the conclusion of the Mercury test, as he was watching Mercury's new ring sparkling on the television, a guard's voice came over the intercom to tell him that his psychiatrist had arrived for an appointment. "I never asked for any psychiatrist. Send him away." He felt exasperated, like he had suffered some great indignity. "Don't be like that, Mr. Ray Diaz," said another, calmer voice, evidently the visitor's. "I can let you see the sun." "Get the hell out," he shouted, but then immediately changed his mind. "No, seize that idiot and find out where he came from."
"Because I know the cause of your condition," the voice continued, still calm. "Mr. Ray Diaz, please believe me, you and I are the only ones in the world who know." At this, Ray Diaz suddenly grew alert and said, "Let him in." He stared at the ceiling for a few seconds through haggard eyes, then got up slowly and picked up a tie from the cluttered sofa, only to toss it back again. He walked over to the mirror, straightened his collar, and combed his hair with his hands like he was preparing for a solemn event. He knew that it was indeed a solemn event. The visitor was a handsome, middle-aged man who walked in, but did not introduce himself. He frowned slightly at the room's heavy odour of cigars and alcohol, then simply stood there calmly as Ray Diaz looked over him.
"Why do I have the feeling I've seen you before?" he said as he looked at the visitor.
"That's not strange, Mr. Ray Diaz. Everyone says I look like Superman from the old movies."
"Do you really believe you're Superman?" Ray Diaz said. He sat down on the sofa, picked up a cigar, bit off the end, and began to light it. "That question shows that you already know what kind of man I am."
"I'm not Superman, Mr. Ray Diaz, nor are you." As he spoke, the younger man took a step forward. Ray Diaz found that the man was standing directly in front of him, peering down at him through the cloud of smoke he had just exhaled. So he stood up. The visitor said,
"Wallfacer Manuel Ray Diaz, I am your wallbreaker."
Gloomily, Ray Diaz nodded.
"May I sit down?" the wallbreaker asked.
"You may not," Ray Diaz said, slowly blowing smoke in the other man's face.
"Don't be depressed," the wallbreaker said, with a considerate smile.
"I'm not," Ray Diaz said, his voice cold and hard like stone. The wallbreaker walked over to the wall and flipped a switch. Somewhere, ventilator fans started humming.
"Don't mess with things around here," Ray Diaz warned.
"You need a little fresh air, and more than that, you need sun. I'm quite familiar with this room, Wallfacer Ray Diaz.
In the images sent by the Sophons, I have often watched you pace back and forth like a caged beast. No one in the world has stared at you for as long as I have, and on those days, believe me, it wasn't any easier for me. The wallbreaker looked straight at Ray Diaz, whose expression was as blank as an ice sculpture, and then he went on. Compared to Frederick Tyler, you are a brilliant strategist, a competent wallfacer. Please trust that this is not flattery. I must admit that for quite some time, for nearly a decade, you had me fooled. Your mania for the superbomb, such an inefficient weapon in a space battle, successfully concealed your own strategic direction, and for a long while I couldn't find any clue to crack your true strategy. I struggled in the maze that you laid down, and at one point almost despaired. The wallbreaker looked up at the ceiling, overcome by the memory of those difficult times. Later, I thought of checking out information from before you became a wallbreaker, but this wasn't easy because the Sophons were unable to help. You know, in those days, only a limited number of Sophons had reached Earth, and as a South American head of state, you had not attracted their attention. So I had to resort to conventional means to gather materials. This took 3 years. In those materials, one man stood out, William Cosmo. You met him in secret on 3 occasions. The Sophons did not record the content of your conversation, so I will never know, but for the head of a small, undeveloped country to meet 3 times with a Western astrophysicist is highly unusual. We now know that at that time you had already been preparing to become a wallfacer. No doubt what interested you was the fruit of Dr. Cosmo's research. How those results first came to your attention, I am not clear on at this time, but you had a background in engineering, and you had the successful experience of your socialism-loving predecessor, who had equal enthusiasm for a nation ruled by engineers. This was a major reason why you became his successor. So you ought to have had the capability and sensitivity to notice the potential significance of Cosmo's research. Once the trisolar crisis began, Dr. Cosmo's research team worked on studying the atmosphere of the Trisolaran stellar system. They speculated that the atmosphere had been produced by a former planet that had collided with a star. As it collided, it broke apart the outer layers, its photosphere and troposphere causing the stellar matter inside to be ejected into space and form a surrounding atmosphere. Due to the total irregularity of the system's motion, there are times when the stars pass each other quite closely, and at those times one star's atmosphere is dispersed by the gravity of the other star, only to be replenished by eruptions on the stellar surface. These aren't constant eruptions, more like volcanoes that experience sudden outbreaks. This is the reason for the continual contraction and expansion of the star's atmosphere. To prove this hypothesis, Cosmo searched the universe to find another star with an atmosphere that was ejected following a collision with a planet. In the 3rd year of the crisis era, he succeeded. Dr. Cosmo's team discovered planetary system 275E1, about 84 light-years from the solar system. Hubble 2 had not gone into operation at that time, so they used the wobble method. By observing and calculating the wobble frequency and light mask, they learned that the planet was quite close to its parent star. At first, this discovery did not attract too much attention because the astronomy community had by then discovered more than 200 planetary systems. But further observations revealed a shocking fact. The distance between planet and star was continually shrinking, and the rate of shrinkage was accelerating. This meant that humanity would, for the first time, observe a planet falling into a star. 1 year later, or rather 84 years prior to observation, it happened. Observational conditions at the time meant that the collision could only be determined based on the gravitational wobble and the periodic light mask. But then something wondrous happened. A spiral of matter appeared around the star, and this spiral flow continued to expand. It looked like a mainspring slowly unwinding with the star as its centre. Cosmo and his colleagues realized that the material flow had been ejected from the planet's crash point. The chunk of rock had crashed through the shell of that distant sun and ejected its stellar matter into space, where, due to the star's own rotation, it formed a spiral. There were several key pieces of data here. The star is a yellow G2 class with an absolute magnitude of 4.3 and a diameter of 1.2 million kilometers, quite similar to our sun. The planet was about 4% of the mass of Earth, or a little smaller than Mercury, and the spiral cloud of material produced from the collision had a radius of up to 3 AU, more than the distance between our sun and the asteroid belt. And it was in this discovery that I found the crack with which to break open your real strategic plan. Now, as your wallbreaker, I will explain your grand strategy. Supposing that you are ultimately able to obtain those million or more stellar hydrogen bombs, you will, as you promised to the PDC, stockpile them all on Mercury. If the bombs are detonated in the rock of Mercury, they'll be like a turbo engine decelerating the planet. Eventually, its speed will no longer be able to keep it in low orbit, and it will fall into the sun. Next, what happened on 275E1, 84 light-years away, is reenacted here. Mercury punctures the sun's convective shell and ejects a huge amount of stellar matter from its radiation layer into space at high speed, which, as the sun rotates, forms a spiral atmosphere similar to that in 275E1. The sun differs from the Trisolaran system in that, as a lone star, it will never cross paths with another star, and therefore its atmosphere will continue to increase uninhibited until it becomes even thicker than the atmosphere of those stars. This was also confirmed by observations of 275E1. When the spiral flow of ejected matter expands outward from the sun like an unwound mainspring, its thickness eventually passes Mars's orbit, at which point a magnificent chain reaction begins. First, three terrestrial planets, Venus, Earth, and Mars, pass through the sun's spiraling atmosphere, losing speed due to the atmospheric friction and turning into three giant meteors that eventually crash into the sun. But well before this happens, the Earth's atmosphere is stripped away by the intense friction of the solar matter. The oceans evaporate, and the lost atmosphere and evaporated oceans turn the Earth into a giant comet whose tail extends along its orbit to wrap all the way around the sun. The surface of the Earth returns to the fiery magma sea of its birth, where no life can survive. When Venus, Earth, and Mars crash into the sun, it exacerbates the sun's ejection of solar matter into space. The single spiral flow of matter increases to four flows. Because the total mass of those three planets is 40 times that of Mercury, and because their higher orbits mean they impact the sun at a much higher speed, each new spiral is ejected with a ferocity tens of times greater than Mercury's. The existing spiral atmosphere rapidly expands until its edge approaches the orbit of Jupiter. Friction produces only a very small deceleration effect on the huge mass of Jupiter, so it is quite some time before the spiral has a noticeable effect on Jupiter's orbit. But Jupiter's satellites meet one of the following two fates. Friction strips them away from Jupiter, and they lose speed and fall into the sun. or they lose speed in Jovian orbit and fall into the liquid planet. As the chain reaction continues, the decrease in speed from the spiral atmosphere, though small, is still present, and Jupiter's orbit gradually decays. This causes it to pass through an increasingly dense atmosphere whose friction accelerates its loss in speed, thereby causing the orbit to decay even more quickly. In this way, Jupiter eventually falls into the Sun too. Its mass is 600 times that of the previous four planets, and the impact that such a massive body makes on the Sun will, even according to the most conservative reasoning, produce an even more violent ejection of stellar matter, increasing the density of the spiral atmosphere and exacerbating the bitter cold of Uranus and Neptune. But another possibility is more likely. The fall of the Jovian giant pushes the edge of the spiral atmosphere out to the orbit of Uranus or even Neptune, and though the atmosphere is quite thin at the top, friction's decelerating effects pull these two planets and their satellites towards the Sun too. What state the Sun will be in, and how the solar system will have been transformed after the chain reaction finishes and the four dense terrestrial planets and four gas giants are consumed, is unknowable. But one thing is certain. For life and for civilization, this will be a hell even crueler than attack by Trisolaris. As for Trisolaris, the solar system is their only hope before their planet is engulfed by their stars. There is no other world they can migrate to in time, and therefore their civilization will follow humanity into total destruction. This is your strategy. Death for both sides. Once everything is prepared, with all of the stellar hydrogen bombs in place on Mercury, you will use it to coerce Trisolaris to surrender and gain the ultimate victory for humanity. What I have just presented is the outcome of the years of work that I, your Wallbreaker, have performed. I am not seeking your opinion or critique, because I know that all of this is true. As the Wallbreaker spoke, Ray Diaz had been listening quietly. The cigar in his hand was more than halfway gone, and he now turned it about as if appreciating the glow of the tip. The Wallbreaker sat down on the sofa close beside him. Like a teacher evaluating a student's homework, he continued, unfatigued. "Mr. Ray Diaz, I said you are a brilliant strategist, or at least you demonstrated many excellent qualities in the formulation and implementation of this plan. For one thing, you took advantage of your own background. Right now, people clearly remember the humiliations you and your country suffered when the Orinoco nuclear facility was forced to be taken down as you were developing nuclear energy. The whole world saw your gloomy face, and you took advantage of outside perceptions of your paranoia about nuclear weapons to reduce or even eliminate any possible suspicion. But every detail in the execution of your plan demonstrates your talent as well. I will mention but one example. During the Mercury test, you wanted the rock to be blasted into the sky, but you insisted on excavating an ultra-deep shaft in a far-sighted gambit. You quite precisely understood the tolerance of the PDC's permanent member states for the cost of this enormous undertaking, and that is admirable. But you had one major slip-up. Why did the first test have to be carried out on Mercury? There would have been plenty of time to bring the bombs there in a later phase, but maybe you got impatient and wanted to see the outcome of a stellar hydrogen bomb blast there. You saw it. Lots of rock matter blasted to escape velocity, perhaps even exceeding your expectations. You were satisfied. But this provided the final confirmation of my hypothesis. Yes, Mr. Ray Diaz, Even given all my previous work, without that final event, I might never have been able to determine your true strategic intentions. The notion was too mad, but it was grand and even beautiful. If the chain reaction triggered by Mercury's fall actually took place, then it would be the most magnificent movement of the entire symphony of the solar system, although, unfortunately, humanity would only be able to enjoy the first section. Mr. Ray Diaz, you are a wall-facer with the makings of a god. It is my honour to become your wall-breaker.